Welcome to another Middle East Forum conference call. Our guest today is Professor Dirk van de Walle, a professor at the Department of Government at Dartmouth College and author of A History of Modern Libya. He joins us today to discuss the situation in Libya and whether it is in the United States' interest to intervene. Thank you for joining us, Dirk. Please begin.
My pleasure, and thank you so much for inviting me. Well, as I think we're all aware, these are pretty gloomy days for the opposition in Libya, as the government seems poised, the Gaddafi forces seem poised to probably retake Benghazi in the next 2-3 days or so, depending on how fast they go. And I think one of the things I wanted to talk about for a minute is, how it is that we've, in a sense, misread Gaddafi quite wrongly on all of this. I think once the initial uprising started, I think many of us had expected that this would turn into a relatively long, protracted conflict. As a matter of fact, I refer to it at some point as kind of a war of attrition, in which the longer the conflict went on, the more vulnerable Gaddafi would become for a number of reasons, including international ability to intervene and so on. And of course, that has not happened. As a matter of fact, it turned out that Gaddafi moved much more decisively than any of us had anticipated. And the reasons, as we now kind of start to figure out, have a lot to do with how he created the political system around himself over the last 40 years. And remember, this is a regime that has now survived for 42 years in some pretty difficult circumstances that included either internal revolts but also international reactions against the way that the Gaddafi government behaved. But what we've seen is that the core around Gaddafi, particularly those that were really the strong defenders of the regime, the ideological guard dogs, so to speak, of the regime, first of all, the Revolutionary Guards, remained very much committed to him. And undoubtedly, that has a lot to do with the fact that these guards had been indoctrinated very carefully over the years, had been specially trained for the protection of Gaddafi. What we also saw, of course, was that Gaddafi was able to surround himself with a number of mercenaries, and that he could seemingly almost at random bring in these mercenaries from some of the sub-Saharan African countries that he had relations with, and that indeed he had helped one way or another over the last 20, 25 years or so. But then the third reason really for why, in a sense, he has survived this so well is really linked to the way that he himself has been able to use tribes and distribute them throughout Libya in an almost perfect divide and rule fashion, and furthermore, in a way that links it even more closely together, has linked these tribal elders to some of the army brigades that are still at his disposal and are headed, or at least two of them, and the most important one, the 32nd Brigade, by his sons. I think we also, in a sense, ignored, and perhaps understandably so, as the battles were going on, but I think we tended to ignore that there always had been some support, sometimes grudging support, but nevertheless support, particularly for Gaddafi in Tripolitania with its business elite, and that Cyrenaica, the eastern province, had always been much more skeptical of Gaddafi. And in Tripolitania, and I should say this was brought home yesterday by a couple of conversations I had, phone calls from friends in Tripolitania, very well educated, that again kind of reinforced what I'm about to say, and that is that even though in the West we tend to think that whatever Gaddafi says and the kind of narrative he has about an invasion and about a fifth column coming in, that to us may seem very strange and to us seems like propaganda, but that is something that is still shared by a lot of particularly Tripolitanians. So the ideological part of Gaddafi's power is also remains very important. And of course, the fact, something we saw very clearly during the uprising, the fact that he has used patronage, that is the ability to simply hand out money very effectively as well. But then the final point I wanted to make on this was that in a sense, one of the reasons that the opposition has been in the trouble that it has been has in part to do because it really was incapable of providing the kind of leadership that you needed to really stand up to a very entrenched regime like the Gaddafi regime. And again, perhaps not so surprising in light of what the last 40 years have told us about and taught us about Gaddafi, but nevertheless, a little bit uneasy in a sense in light of what is going on right now in the eastern part of the country. The bottom line on all of this is, and I think that Gaddafi in many ways has very skillfully over the last 40 years and certainly again during the last month of the uprising, very clearly understood the kind of different interests that exist among Libyans and has exploited those, again, as I said a minute ago, in an almost perfect divide and rule policy. Now, I want to say a few words, as Raymond has asked me to talk about, our reaction, the U.S. reaction, and the international reaction to Libya. And by now, there are several players involved of this. There is, of course, first of all, the Arab League, and the Arab League weighed in last week, but it weighed in a somewhat unique fashion in that it argued that certainly something should be done against Gaddafi, but that it really should come through the United Nations. And the United Nations Security Council then itself, as you know, has been rather divided. The two holdouts, the traditional holdouts, were thought to have been China and Russia, and China's unease seemed to disappear a little bit when it became clear that the Arab League would support any initiative. But the particularly Russia remained quite unconvinced, together with Germany, actually, in the European Union, that I'll talk about in a second. But Russia, in a sense, is almost the outlier here, and my understanding is that it really has very little to do with any actual interest or any ideological opposition, but simply more the fact that Russia, as you all know, has very close contacts with Libya, particularly economic contacts in the oil and natural gas sector. Now, the European Union, you know, remained divided very early on, and has seemingly not been able to overcome that division. The what I would call, for our purposes here, the defection of Sarkozy was seen in Europe as certainly not the way to go, and in a sense may have exacerbated the European Union's inability to really come to a decision. Now, for our purpose, of course, the most important player here, or the most important non-player, I should say, in a sense, has been the United States. And the United States has, on the one hand, clearly been torn between humanitarian concerns, human rights concerns, and so on, all the things we've expressed very clearly over the, and that certainly President Obama has expressed very clearly over the last few weeks. And so if that was one part of the equation, the other equation was, in a sense, what I would call three practical reasons for why, or perhaps four practical concerns for why, particularly an intervention, a U.S. intervention, would not be a very good thing. The first one was that a no-fly zone alone was considered certainly by many people in Washington to be not very productive. That in a sense, if you talk about a no-fly zone, if you really wanted to be effective against the artillery that Gaddafi still had and the tanks that he still had, that you needed to bring in tanks, heavy artillery, armored brigades, if you could, on the other side. And so, in a sense, you needed to have not only what is called a no-fly zone, but what is also sometimes called a no-drive zone, that you had to prevent these heavier artillery pieces and tanks of the Libyans, of the Libyan government, to move forward. The second reason was something that has not been said very explicitly, except perhaps by a couple of people that I'm aware of, but that was certainly that Libya really is not of national interest to the United States. It's of much greater interest to Europe, but for the United States, it's very hard to discern, I think, what really would be a national interest here beyond the kind of rather vague goals of stopping international terrorist organizations, Islamist organizations, and so on, which actually in Libya have, particularly after the folding back of Libya into the international system after 2003 them have not really been a big problem. And then the third objection really was that the administration in Washington certainly thought that any kind of involvement with Libya really would be the kind of the beginning, or no-fly zone, I should say, would really be the beginning of a kind of slippery slope, a kind of the opening of a third war on a Muslim country in a sense that we didn't really want to engage upon. And then the fourth factor, and this came through very clearly in Washington and on some conversations I had, the fact that the administration was really reluctant to engage one side that, although it called itself the National Council, truly did not represent Libyans. And as a matter of fact, that very quickly degenerated in some squabbling among itself and very quickly after it had established itself. And the thought was that in light of the history, particularly of Libya, in which the two provinces, Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, have traditionally been quite antagonistic, that siding with the one side would, in a sense, provide an impetus for a perhaps a breakup of the country. And again, certainly in light of the history of Libya, that, of course, is not something that would be excluded. So that's kind of where we stood in terms of our reaction to it. And I realize, you know, it's a pretty fought-over set of arguments, and certainly people have strongly disagreed with the administration on what it should do. So I'm at about 4:13 on my clock. Let me maybe stop here and turn it back over to Raymond, who will then handle the questions. Raymond?
Thank you for that, Dirk. Laura Lee, please introduce the Q&A.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you select to ask your question. Once again, to join the question and answer session queue, it's star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Dirk, I'd like to ask about something that I recently read in the Washington Post, which said that the Obama administration practically has no clue about who exactly the oppositional forces are. And earlier you pointed out that, I think you said your contacts in Tripoli were confirming that there may, in fact, be a fifth column. And then, of course, we have Gaddafi making, and it's hard, of course, to believe anything he says, but he's insisting that Al-Qaeda is involved in this. So if you can speak a bit about who exactly are these oppositional forces? Are they just disgruntled Libyans? Is it more of a tribal, factious, inter-warfare, or is it, in fact, Islamist?
Right. Well, first of all, the image, of course, that Gaddafi has been using, you know, that there's some kind of branch of Qaeda in Libya, is of course not at all true. Although, again, I was quite surprised that the two people that I talked to in Tripoli, again, quite educated, teach at the university, at Al Fateh University, seem to give some credence to this. And as a matter of fact, one of them said to me, "Have you heard that in Al Bayda?" That they've created an Islamic caliphate, you know, which is, of course, you know, resonates with this whole idea of Qaeda coming in and so on. So, again, if it resonates among some of the citizens, you know, it shows you the level of indoctrination. But what we know about the opposition forces on the opposite side and against Gaddafi is essentially quite little, and quite little in a sense that we know where they come from. A lot of them are local lawyers in Benghazi. Some of them have been national ministers that have worked for Gaddafi, you know, people that have defected from the regime. There is even one quite prominent military commander that was part of the original Revolutionary Command Council. And certainly, you know, these all together have created this kind of national council that has deliberated now. But again, beyond that, what is not really clear yet, and as a matter of fact, really should have given us a little bit better of a clue to what was going on in the eastern part of Libya, was that, for example, we haven't been able to figure out where some of the tribal elders stood on this. And as a matter of fact, what was really striking was that some of the tribes in Cyrenaica had not really weighed in at all. While all of this was going on, they were very, very careful obviously worried about, you know, which way this was going to turn. And there were some of the tribes very early on, or at least some of the tribal elders, I should say, you know, came out in favor of the opposition. Lots of them didn't. And, of course, those are now the ones that are still standing on the sidelines, you know, hoping that at least they will be spared the wrath of Gaddafi if indeed he takes Benghazi. Now, one of the reasons, incidentally, that we know very little about the opposition has to do with the fact that we have very, very few resources in Libya. And that is, we don't really have very good resources on the ground. And a lot of that, of course, has to do with the fact that until, you know, quite recently, we didn't really have an embassy. We were out of the country. Libya was isolated and so on. No one could really go in. So it really was kind of a terra incognita, a kind of a blank slate almost. And so it's not so surprising to me that we're still not very clear exactly on who that opposition was and to what extent, more importantly, the tribes were really folded into that opposition.
Thank you.
Our first question comes from the line of Mr. Lawrence Gould. Go ahead, please.
Professor, as you were speaking, I recalled the wise words of David Price Jones in his book, The Closed Circle. There are two ways of gaining and retaining power in the Arab world, military and finance. And evidently the revolutionary forces were not well set up militarily. If the interests of the European Union are much greater than ours in the area, isn't it the responsibility of the European Union nations, if they think it's necessary to develop a no-fly zone and contending with other Gaddafi forces, and not our position to do so?
Yeah, I would entirely agree with you, actually. I would think that, as you expressed it very clearly, the countries that have the greatest interest in having Libya stabilized would, of course, have been the European Union countries, in part because, you know, as you know, we don't get any oil, for example, from Libya. A substantial amount of Libyan oil goes directly to Europe, and particularly to Italy, together with some natural gas and so on. Unfortunately, even the Europeans, as we now know, couldn't really agree. And you had, again, the two factions, those that wanted immediately to go in and even go beyond a no-fly zone, and those that didn't want to, for essentially somewhat different reasons from the United States. Certainly there was a greater interest, but again, they were very worried. I think what happened in the Balkans to a large extent really determined how careful Europe has become in terms of interventions. And so I think you're absolutely right. It certainly would have been in their interest, and it certainly in terms of proximity and so on, would have been a lot better if the Europeans, perhaps in coordination with the UN Security Council, you know, would have went in very early on, and that certainly could have stopped the armored brigades and so on that Gaddafi had from going eastward and going westward. And so an early intervention could have prevented it. But again, they were, in a sense, also worried about the kind of slippery slope that I talked about in terms of United States involvement. And so, unfortunately, you know, the European Union is set up in such a way institutionally that even one or two partners that object really can slow the whole process down or stop it completely. And that is exactly what has happened in the European Union, unfortunately.
Another part of the question, if Gaddafi regains control, will this hurt our reputation in the Middle East? Because Obama said Gaddafi's got to go, and then he did nothing. How will it affect our relations with the rest of the Arab world and Israel?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Let me take Israel first. I'm not sure at all that it will change our relationship with Israel. But I think in general, the larger question here about our influence in the Arab world, I think, is a very good one. And my personal take on this is that In a sense, we have, we meaning the United States, have really started to lose influence in the United States in the way that we were able truly to influence events probably over the last 10, 15 years or perhaps even 20 years. It seems to be a very slow process. And in a sense, particularly the debacles we had over Tunisia and Egypt, in a sense, did not augur very well, I think, for the way we were perceived in the Middle East. Now, Libya, of course, you know, in a sense, it was a no-win situation either way. Either we could go in, and that would have been seen as some kind of intervention, or else we could stay out, and we could be accused, as we are being accused, of not taking an interest in Libya and in the Arab world in general. So, in a sense, you know, the difficult decision that had to be made was, you know, really weighing whether by intervening or by not intervening, we were really serving the interests of the United States. And again, people came down on different sides on this. My personal take on this is that I think we were better off not intervening. Again, because much like what I said, I also don't see a national interest for the United States in Libya. Again, it's as I said to you a minute ago, it's something that the Europeans perhaps should have handled and not us. And so I think, relatively speaking, the damage is less by not intervening than it would have been if we intervened. So therefore, I would have kind of advocated no intervention.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a speaker a live question, it's star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will take our next question from the line of Mr. Bernard Leventhal. Go ahead, please.
Well, my question has been answered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dirk, I was, you know, obviously not many of us are in the prediction business, but I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what would happen if the Gaddafi regime is, in fact, overthrown. Obviously, if he stays, we sort of have the status quo. But if he is overthrown, what do you foresee happening in Libya? Do you see it as many in the West would hope, that it becomes some sort of democracy, or do you see it becoming once again sort of a civil, factious, tribal inner warfare with another strongman, another Gaddafi type, rising to power? If you can just speak a bit about what would happen if, in fact, the
sure.
opposition takes over.
Yeah, and the first point perhaps to be made is that, you know, this is a regime that, you know, has very, very systematically eviscerated any kind of not only political opposition but also social groups, anything, you know, that could potentially have become opposition. It has exacerbated the relations between the two provinces, between Tripolitania and Cyrenaica, the two most important ones. And Cyrenaica has always been treated rather badly under the Gaddafi regime. So I'm just mentioning that as to kind of give you an idea of the tensions that exist, that would exist in Libya if indeed Gaddafi were to be overthrown. My personal take on this is that, in a sense, we would probably see the emerge, and I mean, and here I should say the international community, and particularly the United States, in that particular case, really could play a very important role, because the country is really going to need a lot of expertise on, let's say, political governance. How do you move toward a democratic system? And, you know, we may not want to think very, very early on yet about the, you know, about kind of a democratic system. We would think about it in the West because they simply don't even have the bare institutions that you need to think about, you know, a representative government, for example. So lots and lots would need to be done before we even get to the point, for example, of elections. But then the big issue, of course, and you raised it quite ad, and sorry, I should also say, economically, of course, speaking, this is a country that really has had a terribly managed, badly managed economy for the last 40 years, and so there's a lot of expertise that would be needed there also. But then, of course, the big problem is, you know, how do you, in this kind of chaos, how do you prevent groups, whether it's tribes, whether it's families, whether it's provinces, from really going their own way, you know, at the expense of trying to keep the country together? And that, I think, if Gaddafi were to go, would be a real problem for Libya. And certainly you would need to think of all kinds of institutional arrangements, let's say a federal system, for example, that can hold the two provinces together. Beyond that, however, in part also because what I described as the divide and rule policy that Gaddafi has pursued so assiduously since he came to power, it's almost unavoidable, I think, that in a post-Gaddafi situation where, you know, virtually everyone at one point or another had to cooperate with the regime in order to survive, in that kind of situation, my hunch is that we would probably see a lot of settling of scores between tribes, between individuals, between the different provinces, and so on. And so unless you could get very early on a kind of a peacekeeping force or something in there, my hunch is that, you know, there probably would be a chance that the country would split apart. And we should remember that, you know, it's perfectly, from an economic point of view, it's perfectly possible to do that. Cyrenaica could have access to its oil supplies, Tripolitania to its own oil supplies in the western part of the country. And while Cyrenaica would be better off, at least both provinces would be economically viable. What you then do with the third province, with Fasan, is, of course, a whole other problem. So in a nutshell, the fall of Gaddafi could really bring back a lot of the antagonisms between lots of different factions in Libya that have been suppressed for the last 40 years.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. We're almost running out of time, but I have your thoughts about one last thing, which is basically, what role do you think the media has played in all this? I gather from you, and I agree with you, that I haven't really seen anyone point out that the U.S. does not have a great interest in all this. But yet, if you watch the media, it seems that there's so many pundits who are just making all sorts of claims and exaggerations, and I'm wondering what you think of all that. Is it actually exacerbating the situation?
Well, I mean, I think it certainly doesn't help. You know, the media does what it needs to do, obviously, and some of the reporting has been quite good. Some of the reporting has just been absolutely dismal. For example, I was reading the New York Review of Books this morning, an article in Libya in which the author got, you know, made major mistakes about the tribes and so on. And so if that happens, you know, kind of at a quality press, you know, you can imagine, I did an interview for ABC where they interviewed me for 25 minutes and then they cut me literally to 6 seconds. And the question was to me, is Gaddafi crazy or not? You know, so the usual kind of stuff that happens with the press, some of it good, some of it unfortunately not so good. I thought also that the Gaddafi government did a reasonably good job for its own propaganda purposes to kind of keep the press circumscribed in Libya. It made a couple of mistakes, but overall, just what I heard from friends made me think that there was a lot more that had not been reported, either in favor of the Gaddafi government or against. But again, you know, a lot of that also has to do, of course, with the fact that the press was really severely constrained in Libya.
Great. No, thank you for joining us very much, Dirk. That was very insightful. And thank you to everyone who joined in the call and participated.
Okay, thank you so much. A pleasure.